Ian's book launch this evening. So good afternoon, good evening, or good morning, depending on what part of the world you're joining us from this evening for the launch of Ian's new book, Clinical Spinoza, Integrating Philosophy with Contemporary Therapeutic Practice. In a moment or so, I have the pleasure of handing you over to Andre and Ian, who will be in conversation about the book for about 30 minutes. And then we're going to open this session out to your questions, your comments, your thoughts. And please feel free to use the chat box down at the bottom if something comes to mind while Ian and Andre are in conversation. I will come back to you and we'll open this up and you can wave your hands at me and I'll facilitate the questions and the comments. I'd now like to hand over to Andre Karatar. He's going to speak about the book for a short few minutes and then be in conversation with Ian. Andre is a training and supervising analyst with the Western Psychoanalytic Society Institute in Vancouver, Canada, where he was recently director. And Andre is assistant clinical professor in the University of British Columbia. He's also on the board of directors of the International Sandor Ferenczi Network, and he's an associate editor of the American Journal of Psychoanalysis. So Andre, please take it away.
Thank you, Annette. And thank you, Ian. I have to thank you for, well, asking me to review your book, which was a pleasure to read. But moreover, for introducing me to Spinoza. I have to say it's been somewhat of a revelation. And reading it was an experience in itself, I have to say, because initially, it was a bewilderment. It was kind of being in a fog of ideas were coming up, floating around, plus Spinoza's way of defining what he was talking about was very mathematical, Euclidean. So there were lots of, let's call them pre-thoughts or alpha elements floating around, you know. But the more I read it, the more I got what he was saying, I was quite the scope of the work was quite astounding, because you're quite right, Ian. Spinoza was very much in line with contemporary psychoanalysis in his conceptualizations. So I hope we'll have some time to elaborate on that. So essentially what I'm saying is the structure of your book was somewhat along the line of developing thought from pre-thought, or going from alpha elements to preconceptions, the concepts, well, beyond grid, basically, mm-hmm. reproduced in the experience. So I recommend the experience to others, but we should move on and talk about you and in your book and what you've done here. So the first thing I'd like to get into, Ian, is how you got interested in Spinoza. Where does your interest lie?
Wow.
Big question.
First, let me tell you about my thrill in inviting you all here and your coming. Right before we started this, I was looking through the books in my office, and I pulled a book of poetry, and I thought I would begin with a verse from Yehuda Amichai, and you'll see why it's appropriate for the subject and begins to answer Andre's question. It's from a poem called The Precision of Pain and the Blurriness of Joy. The precision of pain and the blurriness of joy. I'm thinking how precise people are when they describe an office. Even those who haven't learned to read and write are precise. This one's a throbbing pain. That one's a wrenching pain. This one gnaws. That one burns. This is a sharp pain, and that a dull one. Right here, precisely here. Yes, yes. Joy blurs everything. I've heard people say after nights of love and feasting, it was great. I was in seventh heaven. Even the spaceman who floated in outer space, tethered to a spaceship, could say only, "Great, wonderful, I have no words." The blurriness of joy and the precision of pain. I want to describe with a sharp pain's precision, happiness and blurry joy. I learned to speak among the pains. Spinoza begins, and I'm going to move away from Spinoza in a second, but Spinoza begins with a triad of emotions, of affects. They are pain and they are joy, and mediating in between them are forms of human striving. Okay, and that's the segue from the poem. But first, I know that some of you aren't analysts or psychologists or psychiatrists. So I want to sort of tee up my perspective, how I read Spinoza. It's through the lens of psychoanalysis, which I will define as a kind of three-ply chord. On the one hand, there are multiple theories about the mind, the psyche, and unconscious experience. At the second level, there are different techniques and approaches to the mitigation of human suffering that are based more or less on those theories. And at the third level, there is a cultural element, which has probably been the most successful aspect of psychoanalysis in the 20th and 21st century, which is imbued with value. I have tried in reading Spinoza in this book to come from the second, the clinical dimension of psychoanalysis. And within that, I'm operating from a notion of what I call vernacular expression. And I got this through crowdsourcing. We have at our fingertips the widest or the broadest or the densest psychoanalytic library in all time. It's called the Psychoanalytic Electronic Publishing Archive. And they publish a bestseller list. The bestseller list tells us what papers across the 100 years of psychoanalytic history are most frequently read within the last 5 years. And there are two authors who comprise half of the bestseller list. And they both wrote 60 years ago. So psychoanalysis is a kind of slow moving field. These are Donald Winnicott and W.R. Bion. And so my orientation is heavily Bionian and with some dribs and drabs of Winnicott in it. So let me move from there, the perspective, the lens, to my moment of epiphany, my discovery of what would become the book. And then later on, I'll tell you how I got there. I was sitting on a balcony in Tenerife on a Christmas holiday, overlooking the Atlantic, and it was gorgeous. It was sunny. It was beautiful. And my wife asked me, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm reading Spinoza." And she said, "On holiday?" Because that's my holiday. Anyway, I discerned in this moment this extraordinary thing, that Spinoza appeared, at least to me, as a kind of hinge between that which was very, very ancient and the most contemporary moments in psychoanalytic theory today. And I was thrilled, and I wanted to know more about Spinoza. And this is essentially the same thing that had happened to me about a dozen years ago when I was sitting in a dramatization of a Samuel Beckett short story. And I realized that I was listening to psychoanalysis. And then that went on with Kay Suter to write the development of Beckett's analysis with Bion, and how Bion influenced Beckett and how Beckett influenced Bion. But back to Spinoza. My first stop was a now forgotten history. And I discovered that within psychoanalysis, we have this wide current of Spinoza studies that nobody I know has ever heard of, beginning with Freud and his generation in the German-speaking and writing tradition of psychoanalysis, and then crossing the English Channel in the English development of psychoanalysis, and then crossing the Atlantic in the American development of psychoanalysis. And this extends from roughly 1900 to 1980, when it suddenly peters out. So there's a question, why does it peter out? What's that about? This took me to another two historical moments. One of the German movement of Bildung, or self-formation, which is the kind of crucible of psychoanalytic development in the 19th century. And before that, to the period of the Spanish Inquisition and after, which is where Spinoza comes from. Let's see. The problem with the Spinoza current in psychoanalytic history is it's not historical enough. People are very confused about the form in which Spinoza writes. And I'm thrilled, Andre, that you were thrown into this muddle and had to swim your way out of it. This is a very modern reading of Spinoza. At the outset, people were simply saying that Spinoza was using a form of Euclidean demonstration, a philosophical form that goes back to the 4th century BCE. That had just been used throughout time, and we don't use it anymore, so it's confusing. And there were some authors who castigated him for being so silly. The more modern understanding of Spinoza, which begins with a guy named Harry Austin Wolfson, who was a Spinoza scholar in the 1930s at Harvard. Wolfson opined that Spinoza presents us with what he calls an apperceptive mass, which he likens to iron filings. And our perception, our feeling, our imagination, our desire operates as a magnet, which moves the filings and allows us to begin to differentiate among them and finally to understand something of them. Now, 50 years after Wolfson, the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze said that reading Spinoza, everyone begins in the middle. And that's much like the way each of us who does therapy begins, that a patient comes in, whether it's the first session or any subsequent session, and we are literally thrown into the middle of something into which and from which we have to swim and make some sense. So that's a formal aspect of Spinoza at the outset, which conforms to what we attempt to do clinically. This brings us to a notion of Freud's, which is taken from Aristotle, that the process of psychoanalysis ideally moves us from bewilderment to enlightenment. In his study of jokes, he says that the joke hits us with forceful immediacy. In our business, we call this countertransference. And through it, we are able to take from something seemingly insignificant, something that has enormous significance, which is the step to enlightenment. Now, I'll say one more thing before I revert to Andre. Spinoza uses an example. And it's an example of a silver filigree apple. And I have an example of his apple. Here it is. A silver filigree apple into which, or through the apertures of the apple, one can glimpse gold. So this is a notion that Spinoza gets from the philosopher Maimonides, who is interpreting a line from Proverbs 25:11, which is about silver apples with gold in them. And it really speaks to the notion of there being an unconscious. But Spinoza does one more thing, which is utterly brilliant and shifts for us the notion of what geometric demonstration is. And what he does is extract, while we think of geometric demonstration as this large structure, Spinoza breaks it down and uses it as illustration of what he's talking about, which is in alignment with what was then the new science, Baconian science. So what he does is joins the idea of this silver filigree apple to the idea of a circle within which the thinker can inscribe an infinite number of rectangles. And in showing this geometric example, he actually anticipates what we would call the unconscious and does it in a stylized scientific way. And throughout the book, I'm arguing that this method of the scientific adducement of general rules or general laws that trickle down and get interpreted verbally into particular circumstances characterizes the development of therapeutic science. Certainly in the 1930s, Kurt Lewin advocated this position. And most recently in the vernacular expression, it's characterized by Bion's algorithm. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with Bion's algorithm, what he says is sort of the royal road of understanding therapeutic process. That we move from moments of wariness and persecution and emotional withdrawal toward a reconciliation with reality at time one. And then that shifts. And we go through the same an iterative process to time two and to time three and to time four, whether we're experiencing it in an active way or a passive way. And in this way, you can calibrate moments of change in therapeutic process. Well, what I found was that Spinoza did exactly the same thing, and hopefully we'll get there tonight. Andre.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's always interesting to hear about beginnings, how a kernel of an idea gets started. So that was quite interesting. I'd like to get into some of the meat of the matter of your book. Essentially, his concepts, his ideas, and how they, why they are contemporary. So first thing I'd like to talk about is his monistic view of the human mind body. And he brings into the conception substance, the substance of mind body, or soul, as he would call it. He brings in reflection, an idea of God. What does God mean? In his estimation, God is equivalent to nature, natural law. So when we talk about man's divine nature, we talk about his biological heritage, essentially, as what is divine. So this is very interesting because this is very contemporary, looking at mind-body as monistic and not dualistic as in the Freudian metapsychology, essentially. And so out of that comes his other major idea, conatus. Could you talk a little bit about conatus instead of drive?
Yeah, absolutely. Conatus comes both from philosophers like Descartes and Hobbes, But it also comes from the Jewish philosopher Gersonides. It's a Hebrew translation of the word that comes from the sayings of the fathers. And the word in Hebrew is hishtadlut, and means trying. The English translation for Conatus is often endeavoring or striving. We find that this kind of impulse to thrive, and actually that's what Bion called it, an impulse to thrive, is what Ferenczi called orpha, and it's what Winnicott called going on being. It is the ruthless pursuit of being who we are. And in it, there is an intrinsic affirmation of what we get through perception, or a denial of what we get through perception. So it's registering what comes in from the body. Now, the monism is important because Spinoza draws a line between the body and the mind. And he does this based on philosophy, on the difference between what was first cause and efficient cause. He would argue that our Freudian conception of drive, which itself has to come from a precursor or a set of precursors, which are neuronal, throws us into an infinite regression. Whereas if we're dealing only with mind, which is itself an idea, it's not brain, it's a psychological construct, that mind itself is at least accessible to us, that all of the stuff that you mentioned, substance, that substance is extended over a line, as it were, over a boundary. And Freud calls this dependent concomitance, an idea that the neurologist Hewlings-Jackson came up with in the 19th century. So Freud uses the same kind of model, but opts for a Cartesian dualism in his theory, whereas Spinoza remains monistic. And in this central singularity, we have a fusion of the thinker, the thought, and the object of thought at all times. So you can say it's object-related, but object-related in this, not in the sense that an object follows a drive, but intrinsically related to the idea of mind. Now, to complicate things just a little further, the functions of mind are very important for Spinoza. And in terms of at least my work in talking, they are experience near categories. So there are only a few. There's perception, there's feeling, there's imagination, there's conatus or striving or will. And there is a practical reason, which we exercise for those things. And so what he's talking about, as Bion was talking about, is a conjunctive psychology, right? While in the mind, while internalized, you've got these different functions integrating with each other. But will, for example, conatus, when extended outward into the external world, becomes appetite. And appetite, once it becomes conscious to us, once we recognize what appetite, and that we have appetites, becomes what Spinoza would call desire. All of those things are object-related. And although Spinoza doesn't develop it, there has to be an internalization process, like Ferenczi wrote about in the early part of the 20th century. So we take the effect of what happens in our extension of conatus together with feeling and imagination and into action. We see what its contingency is, and we reintegrate this again through the perceptual channel. And this comes into conflict with ongoing experience. So we've got this multi-leveled sense of action going back and forth. Now, I call this cloudy mathematics. And the reason I call it cloudy mathematics is that in one of the examples that Spinoza gives, he relies on Maimonides again, who was writing about the perception of the tribes of Israel in the desert, their perception of God, where they perceived God or interpreted God as thinker, thinking, and thought, and the object of thinking, all of these things together, as if through a cloud, is what Spinoza says, and that's what Maimonides says in his book, The Guide of the Perplexed. So it occurred to me that what we were talking about, as much as we talk about in Bion's algorithm, is a kind of system of functions which work together, but work together in a way that gives us a shape to think about, but no exactitude. Okay? I mean, it wouldn't pass the evidence-based test. What it passes is the test of the patient's understanding when we attempt to stumble out some language that the patient can apprehend if we're successful. And because like Bion, Spinoza is also talking about the fact that our language is cumbersome, that it's not precise, as Amichai's poem. It's always vague, and it's always tinctured with personal meanings, with parataxes. So going on a step further, Spinoza looks at three levels of thought. One level is opinion, which is completely crazy, but a lot of people simply hold to other people's opinions. The next level is hearsay, like when we read a book and it says, this is psychoanalytic theory. There's a drive and there's an object relation. Well, we don't know that. We take it on its value. That's called hearsay. But the third level, which becomes an approximation to Spinozan truths, is intuition. All right. And so we're back on sort of Bion or late psychoanalysis playing field again. Think about the significant fact. And what intuition is for Spinoza, and this differs from postmodernity, is truth, an approximation to what the ancients called greater perfection, an Aristotelian idea. We would say rather today that what we've got are these moments of transient understanding, which are contextualized and change. So there you have it. That's a big mouthful, I know.
That's great, Ian. So essentially, in a nutshell, Spinoza is an intersubjectivist, looking at the field primarily. That's a great summing up, I think. But you would call that, I mean, Spinoza calls that emendations of intellect, that the point of self-reflection, let's call it self-analysis, is to arrive at, like you were saying, something that is closer to truth, but the truth being what is your substance, goes closer to your substance is pleasurable. What takes you away from your substance is painful. So this is a different conception of the life and death instinct, as Freud talked about, beyond the pleasure principle.
And we're going back to Cartesian thought. There is no life and death instinct for Spinoza. So in terms of correcting for metapsychological fantasies, this takes us right back to what is experience near, because Spinoza is talking about human experience. And although he's often read as a very, very straight-laced character, if you read the texts, and this is really about encouraging you all to read Spinoza. If I'm at all successful, it's as a guidebook through my own subjective experience of leading you through the perplexities of trying to apprehend Spinoza, because there are all these different levels of definition that are cut through with commentaries. It's kind of line of inquiry, and then something happens and something shoots across it and you change direction, and then you hit pay dirt. Something actually works. That's the experience of reading Spinoza. And you have these intuitive moments.
Yeah. But I suggest point that we might open this up for some comments or questions if people had any. If they don't, we'll happily go back to both of you chatting, but we're just at 8:32 Dublin time. And I'm wondering if anybody else has some questions or comments or thoughts they might want to bring into the room. It's absolutely fine if there aren't. We can carry on listening to both of you. I'm wondering if this has sparked any other questions from people. Not at the moment. Andre, I'm sorry I interrupted you there.
I was just saying, I'm interpreting what Ian was saying is, he's talking about a selected fact that is a conjunction, in Leonian terms, a conjunction of a preconception and a realization. And it takes what he would call digestion, because he thinks that Beyond thinks that thinking is an alimentary process. You chew on something, you swallow it, digest it, or you excrete it, basically. So you digest, it takes a while to digest the preconception before realization hits you and it becomes a selective fact. And I had that experience several times reading your book, Ian. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. One of the things that is really cool in reading Beyond is in one of his Tavistock lectures, and I think you find it in the Italian lectures too, he alludes to the book of Ben Sira, or Ecclesiasticus, which was a piece of Jewish wisdom literature. So what Spinoza does, essentially, in terms of textuality, is he moves from Greek thought, which was conveyed to him in Hebrew language, which itself came from Arabic language, which itself came from Syriac, and then from the Greek over 1,000 years. So his major theme, his major way of seeing the monistic world is Maimonidean. And then it collides with contemporary Latin understandings. For example, Seneca, the idea of necessity and sufficiency. But let me change the subject and tell you how I got to Spinoza at all. And it how I happened to be reading him on a balcony in Tenerife. I got to him through Freud's book on jokes. I started reading Freud's book on jokes. And as I said, Freud speaks in Spinozan terms. He talks about feeling. He talks about perception. He talks about imagination. And he talks about this the emergence of a selected fact, the shift from bewilderment to enlightenment. And then I was looking at the joke that he was talking about, and it was a Jewish joke about this fellow whose name was Hyacinth Hirsch, who was a Jewish man who was masquerading as a Gentile. But he was also converted. And this was a story that came from Heinrich Heine. Now, Heinrich Heine also doubled his name, like his character, Hirsch Hyacinth. So Heine's original name had been Harry, and he jazzed it up and called himself Heinrich so nobody would know he was Jewish. And Freud did the same thing. When he was 13 years old, Freud changed his name from Sigismund, which apparently was a giveaway that you were Jewish, to Sigmund. And so he doubled his name. So I became really interested in the phenomenon of social doubling, given that an aspect of your identity was proscribed, was forbidden in a dominant culture. And then reading Heine, Heine sends me back to Spinoza, who Freud agrees with Heine is a fellow unbeliever. Albert Einstein said the same thing. So who is this fellow unbeliever? And it turns out that Spinoza had three names. Spinoza's Hebrew name is Baruch. His Latin name is Benedictus. And his Portuguese name, which was really what he was known as as a kid, was Bento. So I wanted to get to figure out how these different names, these doublings of identity, might have been precursors to the notion of an unconscious. And as I read through this stuff, I also discovered the literature of persecution. Apparently, in the time Spinoza was writing, and before that, in order to say things that were controversial, you had to say them in a multi-dimensional, layered way. The 11th century polymath, Abraham Ibn Ezra, has this phrase that he who understands, or the sage, will understand. And Maimonides wrote in the same way. So you had this literary basis, too, of unearthing the unconscious. And that's the apple example. So then I had to start exposing histories. And in the end, I had to go forward to the development of Freudian thought. And Freud and Heine were still smarting with the same inquisitional fears that characterized Spinozan thought. So that's sort of how I got dragged into this and found myself ping-ponging over two millennia.
If I may elaborate on that a little bit, is the idea that Spinoza's writings and ideas were the outcome of rather tolerant Dutch policy about freedom of expression. Yeah. Very different, the opposite of the Spanish Inquisition, essentially. And we're experiencing similar types of repression, call it, today in various places in the world. But it just sparks even more the desire for the individual to seek for the freedom of speech.
Yeah.
This is what Spinoza, I think, experienced growing up in Amsterdam. And thankful for us and thankful for the world, basically, that there are still places in the world where freedom of expression is highly valued.
Well, it was also in Amsterdam where Spinoza was excluded from the synagogue. Yeah. And he has the world record for synagogue exclusion. He's still excluded from the Amsterdam synagogue. So he holds the Landsee record for synagogue exclusion. My notion was that coming from an inquisitional background, a Marano, somebody who was forced to convert to Christianity, which is what his family did for about 300 years, and then coming to liberal Amsterdam, Spinoza was the first generation to be reschooled in Hebrew texts. But I think that the experience of the Inquisition severely loosened the primacy of religious doctrine. So all around Spinoza are these ex-Catholics who are now Jews. They're new Jews, but they all know Latin and they were all schooled in Catholicism. And Spinoza's like this kid who doesn't know from Catholicism, but he's got these Catholic Jews around him. And then he is excluded for having the same kind of thoughts that they did from the synagogue based on heresy. And it happened at this ideal moment when Holland had separated from Spain, and there was this Presbyterian or Protestant rising, and it began to fragment, and Spinoza's skills in Hebrew were needed by dissenter Protestants. And so he found refuge among these people who wanted to prove or to understand the Hebrew Bible. One of the things he wrote was a concordance of Hebrew. And he also famously wrote the Tractatus, which says that Israel isn't the chosen people, but it was chosenness happened at a historical time, and that prophecy wasn't such a hot thing. His historical moment makes him actually the first Jewish individual in the world, separated from community in terms of personal definition. And the other remarkable thing that Spinoza does, and this is more philosophical, is he shifts the traditional notion of virtue and vice, which is implied in all of the ethics before him, to what we would call a psychodynamic frame. Again, based on pleasure or pain, and its registration, and its integration with thought, and with ego feeling, is what Federn would call it, we have this notion, and we externalize it into the world. And then given our past experience and our present experience, we re-internalize it. And this keeps happening, okay? And the layering of such iterative moments give birth to a concordance of 52 behavioral notions, which are very similar to historical philosophical notions, greed, envy, this kind of thing. What he's trying to do is explode human ignorance. And this is the basis of Spinozan thought, that we don't know. We don't know. And we hide that we don't know with the fictions, the paramnesias, the parataxes, that we do know. And we defend against these things, and it makes us impermeable to knowing. And that leads to greed and to envy and to the desire for honor and the contempt for people who are less fortunate than we are. And Spinoza actually hates that. And several times in his writings, he gets fiery. He consigns to hell people of little mind who operate this way out of primitive ignorance. Now, this leads me to another thing. The basic psychology is projective. Andre, you were talking about the movement from substance to extension, which is fundamental in the first part of his work. But his psychology is entirely projective. And today, following Melanie Klein, we talk a lot about projective identification. But his first example of this, which comes in the appendix to his first part, the first part of Ethics, is in how we create an anthropomorphic God. And we do this because we have all these gifts. We can see, we can hear, we can smell, we can taste. But because we are greedy and because we live in society, we don't believe that any of these gifts are freely given. So we manufacture, we externalize the idea that nobody would give anything for free. There must be somebody giving this to us, a superhuman, a God. And so we create a God through projection, who then in his favor or her favor gives us all these things. And if we happen to be happy and go forward in the right way, we intuit this, we believe erroneously that we are courting God's favor. And if we fail, we realize that we have screwed up. So Spinoza levels this and he says, listen, this is not freedom. To be free requires that you contain your ignorance, that you can hold your ignorance, and that you have to suffer anxiety in doing that. You have to admit that whatever you know, the bulk of knowledge is beyond you. And that, by the way, is why God is ineffable. Today we would call this Gaia, nature. You know, what is it going to do to us? What does it do? We don't know. It's huge, and we're terrified by it. But Spinoza actually provides a path of containment and rational reflection and a kind of settledness with oneself in joy rather than in pain. Because for him, the ultimate gift, the thing that we can do best as humans, is perfect our mind. Which is why in the early part of the 20th century, a great many psychologists and psychoanalysts thought that Spinoza was really the grandfather, the precursor to psychoanalysis.
That's Andrea Salome, the philosopher of psychoanalysis.
Yep.
I think that's a really good point for us to pause. And once again, can I just check if anybody has anything they'd like to say at this point or a question that you'd like to ask? Because it strikes me that's a really good place for us to pause and to say congratulations to Ian on the launch of your fifth book. I'm biased. Some of you don't know me. I may not know that I'm married to Ian, so I've got skin in the game here. But Ian has been enormously prolific since he's come to this side of the pond. This is his fifth book, and I think he's quietly working away on a sixth. He doesn't tell me these things, but I think he is quietly working away on a sixth. And heartiest congratulations to you, Ian, on the launch of this book. I'm enormously proud of you. And thank you, Andre, for taking the time to read Ian's book so closely and to being a conversation partner here this evening. We really appreciate your close reading of that. And thank you all. Can I just say my thanks to all of you for being here. I'm saying this evening because it is nearly 9 o'clock in Dublin. It's obviously very different times wherever in the world you are joining us from. Ian, I don't know if you'd like to say some final words.
Yeah. We are if we read Spinoza properly, we are looking at this extraordinary three-dimensional system of thinking that is built up of a very few number of elements: pleasure, pain, desire, perception, imagination or fantasy, and reflection, inside and outside at different moments of time. And we can stretch this thing into systemic thought. So this I think is the modern project, how to come up with a depth philosophy or metapsychology, as they call it in the business, which extends Spinozan thought to the level of groups and the particulars of what goes on between people. Because beyond all things, what Spinoza has is a relational philosophy. His ethics are about what one mind makes of another mind. And the examples are many. If I love you, and somebody does something to you that hurts you, because joy internally is externalized as love, and pain internally held is externalized as hate. So we get all these complex motivations based on how our objects are being treated by other objects in the world. And with that, I'll close.
Thanks, Ian. Thank you all so much for being with us this evening to celebrate your book launch. Hopefully the next time we might be able to do this in person, in several places, in Ireland, in the States, and in other places. So thank you so much. We hope to see you all in person the next time for the next book.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ian, for the book and a great discussion.
Thanks, London. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hello, Ian.
Hi, Mia.
Can you hear me?
I hear you.
Right now at the